The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to The Guardian Book Club, recorded live every month at King's Place in London. I'm Claire Armistead. With Professor John Mullin this month is Jonathan Coe, author of What a Carve-Up, often cited as the great satire of Thatcher's Britain. The story concerns Michael Pearce, a reclusive novelist commissioned to write a biography of the Winshaws, a wealthy and utterly corrupt family. It's a plot that parodies not only traditional politics, but also the intensive farming industry, the media, and the business of writing itself. Jonathan opened the evening with an explanation. Why he felt the need to make the story so very action-packed.
I was very concerned at the time that people would read it, I guess, and finish it, because I'm a great non-finisher of novels myself. And the reason I often give up on books is that I'm not really all that interested in what happens to the characters after I've read 40 or 50 pages or so. Certainly since What a Carve-Up, I've been the kind of writer who, if he hooks the reader in at all, he does it by means of plot rather than, style or you know, anything particularly elaborate that's going on at the level of prose or anything like that. But I do think that narrative curiosity, it's a courtesy to the reader to make them curious, to arouse their curiosity and to satisfy their curiosity. I now vividly remember being on holiday in Madeira, of all places, and this would have been 1990 or 1991, and taking with me a stack of detective novels, which were not my normal reading, but thinking that, you know, if I'm going to make people finish this book, I don't know why I was worried about that particularly, or why I thought that they wouldn't. Maybe because, you know, a lot of people had started my previous three books and not finished them. That might have been the reason. But I thought, if I'm going to really make readers enjoy and finish this book, then I'm going to have to give them a plot which will make them keep turning the pages. And I knew it was going to be a long and elaborate and complex book and very digressive, and I wanted to take the reader up lots of different alleyways and that sort of thing. So I just knew that there had to be something there at the core, very early on in the book, actually, which would make them read on. And, I think one example of how I tried to do that was in this detail which comes up, as far as I remember, in the first section of the book, the kind of the prelude, which is just about the Winshaws before you meet Michael, where the scent of jasmine is mentioned. And then three or four more times in the first half of the book, Michael smells the scent of jasmine, and this, you know, triggers some kind of suspicion in him and some kind of suspicion in the reader. And you know, that was taken straight from the crime novel, so I took away with me on that holiday, that idea.
There are these things. I suppose you do get them in crime novels. Of course, you sort of also get them in, I don't know, in Dickens and things.
Yeah.
That you get these things that if something is mentioned as being odd, you know, or somebody looks slightly familiar, mm-hmm. and that's one of the other things you do, you know.
Yeah.
Oh, he looks familiar. Oh, never mind.
Yeah.
Oh, I think I've seen that face before, but where is it? I mean, that you snag over and over again on these little presumed clues, but you don't know quite what they're clues to.
Yeah, and people credit Dickens and also Wilkie Collins, I suppose, with introducing elements of the detective novel into literary fiction, into serious fiction. But for me, it does go back even further than that, and it goes back again to Henry Fielding. Not that there's really a mystery element to Tom Jones in the way that we're talking about now, but there are. You know, he does this thing that I do, which is dropping seemingly irrelevant details early on into the book, and it's not until a lot later that you realise the significance of them. You have, you know, the muff that Sophie drops on the floor at the inn at Upton, which, you know, comes back as a key plot device hundreds of pages later.
Yeah.
And as a reader, you know, I love all that. It gives me a tremendous
kick. He also has
that
thing, you mentioned the inn at Upton, he also has that thing but there seems a kind of cast of characters. And although there are other people that you need to meet because of the novel, you know that you'll keep meeting these people again. So I don't know. You meet there's a doc. There's a early on in the novel. There's a young idealistic doctor who's sort of
Dr. Gillam.
Yes, yeah. Who's decimated by the ghastly Henry Winshaw in a TV discussion.
Yeah,
and it's sort of inevitable that years later, when Michael goes to hospital with
she turns up again.
Yep. And it's also inevitable that the person chairing the TV discussion,
Alan Beamish.
Yeah, you
remember
you're
this
very
book,
good. whenever there is a journalist or a TV person, or it's always going to be Alan Beamish down the years. Yeah.
Well, you know, I like that in this book and in books, you know, other people's books that I read for pleasure. And I know people who don't like that and don't like my books for that reason. And you know, people who don't like my books use words like contrived and too much coincidence
what they
and
say,
this kind
yeah.
of thing. But you know, I love contrivance and coincidence in a novel if it's done with a bit of lightness of touch. And you know, it's not done to kind of force plot strands together in a clunky kind of way. But you know, the way that Fielding does it, for instance, and also the other big influence I think on my my approach to narrative is not from literature, it's from film, is Billy Wilder. And, you know, he does that marvellously in some of his films. I mean, one of my favourite moments in all cinema is in the apartment when Jack Lemmon wants to admire himself in his new bowler hat at the office Christmas party, and he asks Shirley MacLaine to lend him her compact mirror, and she lends it to him, and it's cracked. And he realises that it's the same mirror he's found in his apartment the night before, and that she must be the person who's having an affair with Fred McMurray. And that, to me, is just such a beautiful, elegant narrative device and narrative moment. And, you know, I'd give anything to have as many moments like that as possible in my book.
It's funny, in a way, that novelists have slightly perhaps lost a love of coincidences. Because I remember when I did Victorian fiction as a student, the person who was taking the seminar had a competition amongst us, which is the most extreme and unbelievable, yet somehow they get away with it, coincidence in Victorian fiction. And I think the winner was actually not somebody like Dickens, you'd expect. I think the winner was Jane Eyre when she flees Thornfield after this, you know, would-be bigamous marriage and discovering the mistress upstairs and the wife upstairs, and she runs for miles and she gets on wagons and it pours with rain and she doesn't know where she is and she falls unconscious next to a house and the people take her in, and it's her long-lost cousins who help restore her fortune to her, you know. And yet when you're reading it, you sort of almost don't kind of notice that.
I mean, I think it's increasingly difficult nowadays, and that readers expect more and more naturalism, really, from a novel, if that is how the writer is presenting the material to them. I think I kind of got away with it in What a Carve Up better than in some of my other books, because there is, you know, around the edges of what is a kind of solid Victorian style narrative, there are a lot of kind of, for want of a better word, sort of postmodern gestures and parodic things happening and this kind of thing. And the book feels tricksy as soon as you start reading it, actually. Mm. So I think readers are kind of primed to be teased a little bit with those kind of coincidences and those kind of slightly antique narrative devices. Mm. Whereas if you're just telling a story in a more conventional way, then you have to be more careful, a bit more guarded with coincidence, I think.
But also some of the coincidences, sort of like in Dickens, it actually turns out they have they're coincidences, but eventually you find out. But in a way, they're not coincidences. So I don't know, the fact that we're allowed to give away the plot and everything and talk about the ending, by the way.
Right,
so,
okay, good.
So that's, like the fact that Godfrey Winshaw's co-pilot turns out to be the narrator's dad.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, but actually, it's not a coincidence.
No, I mean, actually, that's the whole reason that he's the hero of the novel in the first place, that he's been chosen to tell the story in the first place. So, yeah, that's a very good example, of something which my critics would say, well, look, this is too much of a coincidence. But actually, it's not really a coincidence. It seems a coincidence at the end of the book when you first are presented with it.
Yeah.
But, you know, the plot makes no sense without it, actually.
And there's that other one, which, of course, the wonderful one of Michael on the train with the attractive young woman who...
Reading his book.
I mean, has that happened to you? Have you ever seen somebody reading your novel on a... somebody attractive reading your novel?
See, I'm having to think, yes, it has. It has. And she was attractive, actually. You're bringing it all back to me. And I was was coming back from a family holiday, and I could not have looked more kind of married and encumbered with children than I did at that particular moment. My whole family, I had two children clinging to my legs and big kind of family suitcases, and I was with my wife and everything, and there was this gorgeous woman reading one of my books. So, you know, that was fate's way of telling me to leave well alone, I think.
The funny thing is, I mean, I know it's you who's interesting, not me, but I once, even a poor academic, I once had this experience on the tube of somebody reading right next to me. The chances against this are a billion to one. Yeah. The introduction to a paperback edition of a Daniel Defoe novel that I had edited, and I sidled over, and she was reading the introduction. She wasn't reading the Daniel Defoe. It wasn't just my edition. She was reading it.
There is a famous story somebody tells, isn't there? It might have been John Mortimer or Michael Frayn or someone saying that they saw someone reading one of the comic passages in one of their novels, and they stayed on the train all the way to... It was a tube train. And they stayed on all the way to Cockfosters to see whether they laughed or not. And that story was the germ of that idea, because to a writer that reads completely true. And, of course, if you were alone on your train and you saw someone sitting reading one of your books, particularly an unsuccessful novelist like Michael is, then, you know, how could you resist getting into conversation with them, really?
The book has quite a few little sort of parables about novels and the vanity of novelists, and he's got a character who tells the novelist that novels are all finished, and then the almost perhaps the most evil character in the novel, Hillary, becomes a novelist.
Yes, that's true. You know, as I said, it was, compared to my first three novels, this was always going to be a big kind of baggy monster, and one of the attractive things about that, one of the liberating things about realizing that I had 500 pages to play with instead of 150 pages. Was that I could, I suddenly discovered the inclusivity of the novel, which I'd kind of denied myself up to that point, mainly because of the nature of the subject and the nature of the material I was taking on, and the fact that I wanted to, you know, suddenly switch to a socially panoramic perspective instead of a kind of pinched individualistic one. I realized that I had this, this big playground. This big space to indulge myself in, and I could do things like, bring in a lot of incidental detail and have incidental fun with literary politics and reviewing, and Hillary, the corrupt journalist who becomes a best-selling novelist, and all this sort of thing. And you know, there was what was such fun about writing What a Carve Up was precisely that suddenly I felt free for the first time actually as a writer.
Did you have, you don't have to say who it was, but did you have somebody in mind for the novel that Michael has to review, which he says is written by this person who's acquired a reputation as a sort of deeply caring, politically engaged, fictionally experimental, thoroughly admirable, but Michael knows charlatan?
Yeah. I think I was probably thinking of a future version of myself, actually. I was probably kind of writing the reviews I imagine that I might be getting myself in about 15 years' time, which turns out to be true, so there you go.
Well, it has this other thing, which, you know, I suppose is I don't know if what you meant by post, when you said postmodern earlier, which is you have the freedom, perhaps in a way that a novelist might not have had a couple of decades ago, or a couple of decades before you wrote it, to do things with the structure of it. So you do this thing of having first Michael's story, and then interspersed in that these bits of the stories of these absolutely ghastly sort of characters. Mm-hmm. I mean, do you think that in a novel, which in a way, other ways, provides lots of traditional pleasures of popular fiction of plot and comedy, do you think that's something that is a kind of new... Did you think of that as a new freedom in the 1990s when you were doing that?
Not really, because, I'd done my PhD on 18th century fiction, so I was well aware of all the writers who'd done that kind of thing already a couple of centuries ago. I discovered, as I said, B.S. Johnson, also while I was a student, and he'd done a lot of that kind of thing. I think what felt new to me about what I was doing personally when I wrote What a Carve Up was not that I was drawing on that tradition, although it was kind of there distantly in the background. But all the playfulness of the book, to me, came from outside literature, came from popular culture. And, you know, I'd grown up in the early 70s loving Monty Python. I mean, my ear for dialogue had come from watching television, from watching serious stuff like Play for Today, but also, and kind of more importantly, really, writers like Dick Clement and Ian Le Frenet, who were great writers of spoken dialogue. And then when I decided that I wanted to write a political novel, again, what was at the back of my mind, and what is, you know, a very clear influence on what a carve-up I think is stuff like Beyond the Fringe and Yes Minister and Spitting Image more contemporaneously with the time when I was writing. So really all the that's where the comedy and the playfulness and the comic energy of the book comes from, I think. It comes from those kind of sources.
Did you have in advance a kind of menu of the Winshaw sins, what they were going to be?
Yeah, that's exactly what I had, and I probably still have it somewhere if I can if I can dig up my old notebooks for the book. But one morning I went to the reading room of the British Library in Great Russell Street, as it then used to be, and just sat down with my notebook and made a list. And it was politics, culture, finance, food production, arms dealing, and what's the sixth one? Media, Hillary. Yeah.
And that's a source of, in Michael's account, of a sort of another kind of coincidence, I suppose, which is that it strikes him that, oh, his dad has died, and his dad has been eating this food that mm-hmm. Dorothy produces. Or there's the appalling and actually sort of rather documentary account in its detail of when he takes Fiona into the hospital and there's endless delays, and these delays are sort of fatal, actually.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's actually all Henry, really, or it seems to Michael that it's all Henry.
Yeah.
And I sort of, I suppose that was a place where, that was the way in which Michael and the Winshaws sort of interact, but it's slightly, even that's quite a sort of heightened thing, isn't it? It's his slightly, you know, what's he says, I believe in conspiracies. Mm. He starts believing that everything is done by the Winshaws.
Well, yeah, when the novel is taught in universities, apparently one of the courses it finds itself ending up on is paranoid fiction. I didn't realise that there was such a thing, let alone that it was taught in universities, but that's where What a Carve-Up often finds itself.
And does it seem to you now, I mean, you were saying you don't like rereading your own novels. Does it? I mean, it's a novel which seemed to be about the 1980s, I guess. Mm. Even down to it's Henry, isn't it? Winshaw conceiving a sort of unfulfilled sexual passion for a young Margaret Roberts, mm-hmm. and when he's at university. I mean, when you were writing it, all that stuff must have still sort of been hot in your head. But I mean, did you think that it would? You would have to kind of be careful not to make it seem a novel of its times.
No, I wasn't thinking about that at all, really. I mean, what I wanted to do was capture the moment, and capture the actual moment at which I was writing it. In fact, because, you know, I was watching when I wrote the first scenes in the novel. Sometime in 1991, I was literally sitting in front of the television watching scenes of the Gulf War, the first Gulf War, as we call it, unfolding. That was one of the things that gave me a buzz about writing it, actually, the thought that I was making it as contemporary as I possibly could, and that was the object. I didn't think for a moment about what it would read, how it would read in 5 years' time, or 10 years' time, or 15 years' time. That just didn't occur to me. Mm.
And what about the what you referred to earlier, the use of film? I mean, you gave lots of examples of how film and TV influenced the novel. And of course, mm. what we haven't talked about is the most obvious one. And there's a sort of a bit of it on the cover of the paperback, and it's in the title, What a Carve-Up.
Yeah.
This particular film, which I confess I still haven't ever seen.
You haven't missed a masterpiece. Don't worry.
Well, I feel like sort of, I feel I've kind of got the hang of it because I know when in the extraordinary last section of the novel, which Michael sort of says, oh, we're, you know, give some examples of the kind of plot that the characters are inside, and one of the examples he gives is, I think, another example from the genre of What a Carve Up, the comedy thriller, I suppose.
Yeah.
Which is Theatre of Blood, which I have seen. Mm-hmm. Isn't that where Vincent Price bumps off various... He's a crazed Shakespearean actor who... And everybody's death has a sort of appropriate quality or scenario.
Yeah, that's right. They all die Shakespearean deaths because of the terrible reviews they've written of his various performances.
and in this novel, all the Winshaws die a death, which is to do with their particular sins, I suppose.
Yeah, yeah. I guess Theatre of Blood is at the back of that. Is it mentioned in the novel?
Yes, it is.
Directly?
It is, yes.
Okay, I'd forgotten that. But I've always loved that genre. I've always loved comedy horror, not just the What a Carve Up film that I allude to in the book, but the Bob Hope films from the 1940s, the Cat and the Canary and the Ghost Breakers and those kinds of things.
And somebody says, actually, this smacks of the scenario to a third-rate horror film.
Yes.
Interesting you should say that, said Michael. Perhaps some of you saw a film called Theatre of Blood.
Oh, well, there you go.
Page 452.
I do like to spell out my allusions and my references, just in case anyone's in danger of missing them.
So was that the last section, which is terrifically sort of self-parodic of... Oh, and it's got Agatha Christie in, and it's got secret passages, and everybody's being bumped off, and a character, of course, as in Agatha Christie, a character everybody thought was dead, is not dead, but is masterminding these.
Yeah, I do remember writing that section. It was the only part of the book I wrote quickly. I didn't have a contract for this novel, and I can't remember who was the first person I sent it to. I think it was probably my agent, but I remember sending him everything I'd written up to that point, which was the first part of the book, up to and including the death of Fiona. You know, he didn't know what on earth to make of it, really, because everything was kind of up in the air. And I hadn't written the final section at that point. So I don't know why this fact has stayed in my head, but I wrote it in 3 weeks, again, in the reading room of the British Museum. And, it was an absolute blast to... And it was what I'd been kind of... slavishly building up to for the last 2.5 years of writing, really, just this kind of joyful moment of release when I could both, you know, become the kind of writer that I was longing to become, which was a sort of comic Agatha Christie, and also, you know, after living with and creating these monsters and making them do terrible things for 2.5 years, I could finally dispatch them and send them to the places that they deserve. So it was a richly enjoyable 3 weeks of my life. I do remember that. What a Carve Up was a film I saw myself at the same age that Michael Owen does in the novel, but he's about 9 years older than me, I think. I think I have him born in 52 or 53. So I have him seeing it in the cinema on its first release in 1961. I must have seen it at the same age. The age of 7 or 8 in 68 or 69 when it was shown on television. And, you know, it made a big impression on me because it's kind of a carry-on film, but it's much better than any carry-on film, I think, from the direction point of view. It's directed by a guy called Pat Jackson, who made a wonderful documentary in the 1940s called Western Approaches, shot a kind of semi-documentary feature film set during the war. And... you know, is one of the great forgotten directors of British cinema of the 40s and 50s. Might still be alive, I think. I know I did an event like this about What a Carve Up in about 1996, and he turned up rather amazingly and rather wonderfully. So the horror aspect of the film is actually quite well done, and it is parts of it are quite creepy, and that must have been what stuck with me. But then it was one of these films that disappeared into a kind of rights limbo and didn't turn up on television for about 20 years. And then it turned up towards the end of the 1980s, and I watched it again and enjoyed it again. But it was the title that grabbed me because I'd conceived this novel by then and didn't have a title for it. And I just thought, that is the title, I'm going to steal that. And as soon as I'd thought that, I thought, well, there are other things I can steal from this film as well. And in fact, the whole template of the novel is there. And, you know, I hadn't decided what I was going to do with the Winshaws at that point, and the idea of having them all gather for the reading of the will and being killed one by one suddenly seemed absolutely perfect. So it was just one of those happy coincidences, really.
And there's this bit you steal from the film, which is the bit of the film which is replayed, which is there on the cover, which is replayed over and over again. I mean, at least sort of, in a way, at least five or six times in the novel, which is poor old Michael sort of doomed to repeat, which is the slightly carry-on-ish moment, I suppose, where the main character in the film blunders into the beautiful woman's bedroom as she's getting undressed.
Yeah.
And in the end, she sort of invites him to stay, and he flees. Mm-hmm. And that's a scene, isn't it? That the young poor old Michael. You know, I think he says to Fiona later on in the novel, he tells her he's obsessed with this film, and talks about this particular scene. He says, "I don't know why I'm so preoccupied with it." And she says, "Well, it's your life, isn't it, mate?" Sort of thing.
I mean, you know, again, you can find. There's no end to what you can find in popular culture, I think, and there's no end to its resonance. And you know, we shouldn't underestimate the impact that all of these moments that we glimpse on celluloid and on television early in our lives can have on us in the future. And that scene with Kenneth Connor has always struck me as being, you know, it played as a bit of throwaway comedy, but it's kind of archetypal of a certain kind of repressed English sexuality. Which, you know, it's 1961, so it's just before. I mean, oddly, in one of the gags in the film is that the butler is downstairs drunk, reading a copy of the Penguin edition of Lady Chatterley's Lover, which exactly dates the film and rather wonderfully contextualizes Kenneth Connor's kind of moment of repression, because, you know, a few years later, after the floodgates that kind of thing had opened, then Kenneth Connor's response makes no kind of sense, really. Another person that I got to meet and got to know because of the novel is Shirley Eaton herself, who has become a friend and so on. And she, what Michael Owen does, of course, is masturbate in front of this scene repeatedly. But it's rather, as far as I remember, it's rather obliquely described.
Yes.
And it was about the second or third time I'd had dinner with Shirley that she actually said to me, "Jonathan, what is Michael doing in that scene in front of the television? I mean, I read it again the other day, and is he sort of playing with himself?" And it had never occurred to her that what a scene from one of her films might inspire this kind of activity in one of the viewers. She was both shocked and rather pleased, I think.
So, if anybody here would like to ask Jonathan a question, we've got a couple of mics. There's a lady right at the back.
You touched on this a bit in the beginning, but I just wanted to get some more clarification. When you started writing the novel and you wrote Michael, the character, as an author, was that sort of a purely sort of plot device to kind of tie the narrative of the Winshaws together, or was there something more behind that? Was there anything autobiographical that you wanted to put in about your experiences as a writer?
Well, initially it was purely a plot device that, you know, I wanted to find a way to incorporate as much of the history of the Winshaws' activities as possible, and to have someone there writing a book about them was just a kind of simple way of doing that. But as I was saying earlier in the conversation, one of the things I realised what a capacious kind of structure and form I'd allowed myself was that I could, you know, I could bring in as much as I wanted from my own experience, including my own experience of writing and reviewing and the other things I've been doing in the years up until that point. So, you know, Michael is not me, but there's a lot of me in him. The names of his two novels, as far as I remember, are clear signposts to my first two novels. Accidents Will Happen, so The Accidental Woman, and The Loving Touch, I think, is it?
Yeah.
Touch of Love, yeah. Again, you know, trying to make it as easy as possible for people to pick up those, pick up on those references. So yeah, he both is me and he isn't me.
You talked about the importance of coincidence and signals throughout the novel. I was just curious to know how you go about constructing them. So do you get to a certain point and think, oh, it would be useful if this happened further back and then go back? Or do you always know the direction?
No, there is a certain kind of dry mathematical aspect to doing it, and sometimes you move things back a certain number of pages, that kind of thing. I mean, I've got more and more free and easy about this as I've carried on writing. But as far as I remember, in the case of What a Carve-Up, I decided exactly how many chapters there were going to be. I decided exactly how many words there were going to be in each chapter. I mean, I sometimes stuck to that, I sometimes didn't, but it was always in the same sort of ballpark. And I had those plot points where the reader is nudged, like the smell of jasmine and so on. I had those placed at what seemed to be appropriate intervals and that sort of thing. So I think of all my novels, it's the one where the structure was most rigid and most pre-planned. That's my memory of how it was.
Is that difficult to do?
No, it's almost as much fun as the other thing I was talking about, which is when you get to the end of the novel and you're kind of freewheeling down the hill and everything is coming together. Those are the two parts of writing that I enjoy most, actually. I heard a phrase today which I'd never heard before, which was reported to me about another writer who was asked at what stage of his writing his latest novel he was at, and he was saying, oh, I'm at the point when I have to start wording it in. I'd never heard that before, but I know exactly what stage that is. It's when you've done what in film terms is the storyboard, and everything you've concretized everything as far as you can without actually sitting down and starting to write the words, and that's the difficult, boring, sloggy part for me is wording it in, which as I said took about 2.5 years in the case of What a Carve-Up, and that process gets easier and more fun towards the end when, if you've done the job properly, then the narrative strands start coming together and the book kind of starts writing itself. But the early stages of writing a book are kind of tough and no fun at all in my experience. Whereas thinking up structures, thinking up plots, that's great. I love doing that.
How much did you have to change after it'd been read for libel?
Nothing. I don't think anything in this book was changed for libel. I mean, my current editor is in the room, but he wasn't the editor on What a Carve-Up. I don't know if he can remember if there were any discussions at Penguin about libel, but I don't remember being party to any such discussions. I mean, I think the arms dealer called Mark was probably treading on as thin ice as anything. I don't really understand the laws of libel as they apply to fiction, to be honest. I still don't really understand them, because when I did my biography of B.S. Johnson, that was combed for libel, and things which I thought were incredibly mild and safe were taken out of that book. But that's the only time I've had one of those discussions for a piece of non-fiction.
Yeah. Hi. You said that you had Michael killed off to show that Winshawism is still alive at the end of the novel.
Mm-hmm.
Does that mean that you're not surprised by how Winshawism has endured and by the enduring relevance of the book?
No, I guess I'm not surprised, really. I mean, I'm disappointed, obviously. But, the moment, the historical moment at which I wrote What a Carve-Up seems unimaginably remote now, in a way. Not because of where the Tory party was at that time, but because of where the Labour Party was. And, it was written when Neil Kinnock was leader of the Labour Party. Probably John Smith had taken over by the time I wrote the second half of it. But at a time when, whatever you think of those figures, a real alternative to Thatcherism was regularly being articulated by leading politicians, which is not the case anymore, I don't think, certainly not convincingly. I guess I am surprised by quite how relevant some of it has become. Someone was, a journalist was reading back to me the other day some of the things that Thomas Winshaw, the investment banker, says, which I hadn't really read or thought about since I wrote them, and they did seem as though they could have been written, easily written in 2010 or 2011. And the thing I felt I was going out on a limb about was Dorothy Winshaw and the intensive farming and so on. And I'm still slightly baffled by that. I'm still slightly baffled by why I decided to go with that and why I made it or tried to make it such a powerful and upsetting part of the book, because it wasn't really something that many people were talking about at the time. And it was the hardest thing to research because there was virtually no literature about it that I could find very easily. But that quickly came to seem quite prescient, and you know, and BSE was in the air pretty soon after the book was published.
It's funny because ever since I read the book, I can almost play the film of the book in my head, and I can sort of see all these scenes that would be in the film. And I've often wondered why we've never gone down that route, or if it's going to be possible. And just as a rider to that, I just wonder if that ever was to happen, whether it would actually have been better to have worked then, or would it still work now, in your opinion?
I think it would still work now. Not just because I'm the writer of the book and I would get money for it if it happened. It is actually something I'd love to see on screen at this particular moment. In fact, I think it would be quite cathartic in some ways. It's just been a, you know, the screen history or non-history of What a Carve-Up has just been a catalogue of missed opportunities and near misses and those kind of things, really. I mean, it was optioned before it was published, and was very, very nearly made into a series for BBC Two back in 1994. And then I think once something like that gets that close to being made and then misses, then it develops a kind of bad smell around it, and no exec really wanted to hear about it for quite a long time after that. Actually, what's something I meant to do before doing this event was to email Jeremy Dyson of The League of Gentlemen, who has written a script of What a Carve-Up, the latest script of What a Carve-Up, and that is that was going to go into production for Channel 4, and they went cold on it, and it's now with the BBC, I think, but I don't know at what stage it's got or whether it's likely to happen. It's a fantastic script. I mean, it really does improve on all the book's weaknesses and brings it bang up to date. I mean, it's still set in the 1980s, but it really finds and plays up the modern parallels, and it's, you know, it's funnier than the book and more savage than the book in some cases, but don't expect to see it on your TV anytime soon.
It's a shame. I could see the character actors licking their lips at the thought of...
Well, yeah, great character actors, and you know, it's a measure of how long this has gone on that the discussions we had about casting in 1994 are meaningless now, because most of the people we talked of as possibles to play the Winshaws are dead. So we would have to find a whole new generation. I mean, we were going to cast it with kind of carry-on actors and Leslie Phillips and people like that, who is still alive, thankfully. And have Shirley Eaton as Michael's mother in a kind of weird Oedipal twist. I guess not much of that could happen anymore.
Hi there. I just wondered, since popular culture has changed so much since you wrote this book, whether your attitude to using it in your fiction has changed, and also your sort of use for it in fiction as well.
Yeah, that's a good question. I think it has. You know, popular culture is also youth culture, I think, to a large extent. And partly in that, you know, a lot of what I see on television, certainly in comedy, just doesn't really appeal to me. I just don't really get it, and I don't feel it's, you know, I don't feel it's meant for me, really. I mean, I can see why something like The Inbetweeners is funny, and I can see how good it is, but it doesn't really make me laugh, because I just think it's aimed at a different generation altogether. So I couldn't imagine myself kind of tapping into it in the way that I tapped into the things that were, you know, contemporary with me when I was writing What a Carve-Up, or contemporary with me when I was growing up. But the alternative to that is kind of being locked in a sort of permanent nostalgia, which I think I, you know, I indulged myself as far as I would go in that direction with the Rotters Club, and wouldn't want to go back there again. And, you know, I don't want to become, you know, the kind of novelist who writes novels about spangles and space hoppers and that kind of thing. So I think if it, you know, if it doesn't, if popular culture is not feeding your creative energies now, you know, in a very contemporary way, then it's probably, you know, it's best to leave it alone, I suppose.
Are you planning to write any more satirical novels? And if not, why not? And did you know at the time that What a Carve Up was kind of going to be your one shot?
No, for the reasons I said earlier, not satirical. I mean, that doesn't rule out writing novels, political novels set in contemporary Britain or elsewhere in the world. It doesn't rule out writing comic political novels. I'm using politics to mean to talk about the subject of the novel, really, rather than its position. I don't plan to write novels which take up a particular political position, I don't think, in the way that What a Carve Up does, because, as you say, I think somehow with this novel I found a way of doing that brings most people on board, and the novel is, there are things going on in the novel which are quirky enough and ambiguous enough and complex enough for me to sort of get away with the political attitude, which is very sincere, but quite, you know, quite simple and straightforward. And you know, if I could find a way of doing that again, I might do it. But I can't. I can't find one at the moment. And people, you know, people say, "Are you going to write another What a Carve Up?" Because everything is the same, and you know, it's just as relevant now as it was then. And you know, my answer to that is, well, that's the reason why I won't want write another What a Carve Up, because it would just be, I'd just be repeating myself.
Are we going to release Jonathan? Oh, no, we're not going to release Jonathan for his Guardian Chardonnay yet.
I just wondered, given your interest in film, whether you've been approached or are thinking of writing screenplays.
Being approached is the right way of putting it, actually, because I'm a bit passive about this. I tend to wait to be approached rather than being more proactive about it. I mean, it's a very difficult, not to say soul-destroying business, trying to get a film off the ground in this country. I've just been approached to write a film in France where my books have a big audience. And, you know, that's kind of tempting. It's quite an interesting project. But I find the politics of the British film industry and the, you know, the constant sense of embattlement, you know, it's difficult to be creative in that kind of context, I find. And the great thing, you know, my great good fortune with the books that I write is that I'm free to write whatever I want, really. And that's certainly not the case when you're writing films in this country or in most countries. So it's, I mean, I'd love to, because as you say, I'm a great enthusiast for film, and some of the most important influences on what I do have been cinematic rather than literary. But it just defeats me to jump through the hoops, really.
Perhaps producers will listen to the podcast. And
there's a podcast?
There's
you never
a
told
podcast.
Me that.
We're not just... Oh, yes. This is podcast.
Oh, my God, what have I said? Woodrow Wyatt's heirs will be on my back.
There are heirs as well.
Oh, now you tell me.
I just wanted to say that... I'm sure on behalf of all of us, to thank Jonathan very much for coming and talking to us.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.